Presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Enough! Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Thursday. Race fans, Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports 0964. If you're listening to Sirius XM online and at our website, stevebick.com, a absolutely glorious day upstate New York, and we inch closer toward Saturday's big day. The Whitney, always a highlight on the Saratoga calendar, and to its credit, under the duress of the current situation, it's in its normal spot, which is cool. Of course, next week we'll be building up to Travers, and it is not in its normal spot, but it's not going to diminish what's going to be a great day next week, and not going to take away certainly from the card on Saturday, which came up just terrific. Just terrific. And the Whitney, as we told you in the third hour yesterday, if you're listening to the replay and, you know, rolling right into the live Thursday edition, the five pack that is really a group of elite older horses, including 7-year-old Tom's Detat, who draws the widest with Joel Rosario. And yes, this comes down, it seems, you know, to him and Code of Honor and Improbable. But Mr. Buff, very respectable and certainly likely to set the pace by my standards, comes. And Brett Calhoun and Chester Thomas, Jose Ortiz, Irad on Improbable, Johnny on Code of Honor, of course, Junior Alvarado on Mr. Buff. So the five that make up the Whitney, and the Whitney's going to go as the ninth, 542. Positioned nicely for all the TV coverage, the start of the late pick four. Also part of a very challenging, a very tough cross-country pick five. We'll handicap tomorrow and dig into it and try to figure out an approach. Very similar to last week, actually, with two at Saratoga, two at Woodbine, and one at Monmouth. The Monmouth is the Monmouth Oaks, and the Monmouth Oaks for $200,000, you know, keeping real money involved, came up very good. And the two races at Woodbine are both full fields and are eye crossing, as if last week wasn't quirky enough. Two to consider at Woodbine with the Whitney and the Alan Jerkins. So should be a very fun and potentially lucrative cross-country pick five. The pick four that comprises the most contentious of the stakes, and of course there's also Midnight Bisou in the personal ensign, and while she's a likely winner and she's got everything to respect about her posture in here and her presence, this is not a slam dunk, because Vexatious and Point of Honor are well within her, her area code. So six horses in the personal ensign, which goes mid card, goes as the fifth. 328. Looking forward to Midnight Bisou back here. And then lots of other great maiden action. We got 2-year-olds on the card. We've got a little bit of everything. So the stake sequence of the pick four, though, is the is the meat of the Whitney day. And the Whitney starts that group. Then the Allen Jerkins came up tremendous. 11 of them. And these three-year-olds, you've got all the things you want. You've got three-quarter type sprinters going the seven. You've got turnbacks. Tap it to win. Draws outside for Johnny and Mrs. Weber and Mark Cassie. Three technique turning back for Maya Engelhart and Bill Parcells, Jose Ortiz. No parole, tries to parlay his downstate grade one success into, you know, another one of the most important grade one turn races for sophomores. The Allen Jerkins, hopeful treasure. Pino, 8 rings, of course, as Baffert had said, he was sending him here. Sonneman, Steve Asmussen, also Echo Town for Asmussen. Mischievous Alex for Chuck Zackney and Cassius King and John Service. This has been their target literally since, I don't know, since April. No parole, shoplifted. So that gives Asmussen 3 in here, right? Yeah, 3. 3 technique. Maya's got 2 as well because he's also got Captain Bombastic for Team Hanley. Liam's Pride. Doug O'Neill shows up in here with Liam's Pride. Kind of a interesting fit. Dylan Davis draws it. I mentioned Captain Bombastic, the 10, and Tap It to Win. There's nothing better than one of the most important grade ones for sprinters of the three-year-old variety. It came up tremendous. The Bowling Green leading toward the Sword Dancer and a 7-horse field in here. And you can't run anything on the grass past 9 furlongs without Mike Maker. Marzo and Cross Border in here for the Wyckoffs and Maker with the Ortiz brothers. They line up shoulder to shoulder. Highland Sky, for the Youngs and Barkley. Dot Matrix, who, I tell you, at first glance, for 10 Strike and Brad Cox, I thought he looked okay in here. Randy Hill has got Channel Maker, also contentious. Tom Albertrani sends Woods Lanes, wonderful, venerable 7-year-old Sadler's Joy, and Pillar Mountain, Pletcher, Team Valor. 7 in the Bowling Green, nice. And then the Caress, as if, you know, this wasn't an interesting enough sequence. The Multis end with the turf sprint with the $200,000 Caress. Field of 10 in here. And a lot of familiar season-long filly and mare types signed on in here. And of course, the name Clement is just jumping off the page. Every race you're looking at, you immediately have to, you know, look at what Christoph is sending out, because he continues to win. And that included yesterday. We'll talk about the results in a second, but a field of 10 closes things out. So a really, really nice Whitney Day card. And you know, I know that Nick mentioned this, and I've started to, you know, dig in daily to the cards. They're getting, and Andy actually said this too, I think, on Tuesday. The cards are gaining momentum, actually. I know, you know, there had been some concern about how, you know, how deep the fields would remain as the season went on. But frankly, it seems like we're gaining momentum. And the cards, day after day. I mean, I've looked again today at the last 6 and had a decent enough day yesterday. And I was a little irked about a couple of results. We'll talk about one in particular that did not seem to sit well with the listenership, but I think it's a little unfair. We'll talk about that in a second. But you know, the puzzles day to day are really good. And today, again, we're going to come right back and go at it. And a beautiful day weather-wise. I haven't looked ahead, but I'm hoping Saturday we're not going to have to deal with anything. I'm just curious, actually, now that I say that. I hadn't looked ahead that far. So looking forward to Saturday and weekend preview tomorrow. That'll really dig in. And there's just a little. It looks like Monday, Tuesday. It looks like the early part of next week you're going to get some inclement weather, but it looks okay the next 72 hours, so we should be okay. Yesterday, let's talk about this for a second, and in the hurdle race, Bob LaPenta, the familiar maroon jacket with the gold epaulets, Jack Fisher just dominant right now and for an extended period, and Fast Car just absolutely ridden by Mitchell, like he couldn't lose, and then he went out and just ran away in the end from the field. And this was a resounding win, and you got 1060 if you latched on to Fast Car. And the Hendrix entry, Global Freedom, ended up second in here with Darren Nagel, and Ross Garrity checked home third after setting the pace for Jonathan Shepherd and Sherry Fenwick. But Bob LaPenta, a winner over the hurdles. Pretty cool. I mentioned Albert Tranney, and speaking of winners yesterday, including Clement, whistling in the dark at a big price. Kendrick Carmouche, you never have to worry that your horse, whether you bet on him or you own him, you're not going to have to worry that Kendrick isn't going to put you in the race kind of asked and smooched at, takes control, and Kendrick holds everybody safe at 24-1, 49-40 for Whistling in the Dark, a New Year's Day filly bred by 3Cs here in New York and owner Chris Larson. And so that kind of got the day, kind of put the spurs to the day. And, then Gary with the first win of the meet at a nice 15-2. I don't know. David Aragona doesn't misfire too often on lines, but it was kind of crazy that Five Alarm, he had Five Alarm Robin at 5-2. And, she wasn't all that appealing at 5-2. She felt appealing at 9-2, 5-1. And then just floated up and ended up, Manny Franco takes control. I mean, Andy talks about this nonstop, and it drives him insane, drives everybody insane. Horses, either trying to rate them and have them sit off. If the horse has got tactical speed, get him in the race. And the result here was Five Alarm Robin not only pays 1680, and congratulations. I want to mention, this is Dominic Salzano, who's just entered the game. It's his first horse. It's his first winner, and excited for Dominic. And Gary's got a lot of new, he's kind of shifting the cast, and he's got some up and coming types and a few people that are new to the game. So always great. And Five Alarm Robin, really good in here. And then you had 2 30-1 shots, essentially, second and third. And so, the mutuals were bonanzas. There were three horses that went off below 3-1. And none of them were closer than fifth. Positive Skew was dull early and then got untracked late. But it was too late. And Stormy Derby Day, it took a bunch of money, and I didn't get that at all. Anyway, so the fur was flying early here on the flat side of things. And first line, the first Samurai for the Noda brothers and Orlando Noda. And I'll tell you what, they win, and they do a nice job. This was a horse that I had sort of kind of woven in, but didn't Asham, the Shadwell looked really strong in here and was very mild and just sort of got involved late, but very meek rally. And in the meantime, hometown set the pace, and Jose Ortiz, 12-1, 26.80. Then came the day at the Spa, and Clement Rosario, they're winning, you know, races in bunches. They also had We Get the Monies, who was third in here. Chad in between, who's a little bit, you know, Chad's a little, he's been cool. He's got a little bit, the winless streak probably ends today. He's got a couple of really nice ones, but it's been suddenly a bad period. It happens. Happens to everybody. But Classic Lady, a Jimmy Creed mare for Michael Dubb and partners. And interestingly, it was a Dubb and partner exacta because War Canoe second in here for Dubb and partners, including Mike Caruso, whenever you see Bethlehem Stables. And I guess it's time for my annual reminder that Mike Caruso, one of the greatest scholastic and collegiate wrestlers in history, Wrestling Hall of Famer. So that gets us to the sixth, and we got some big will pays. The pick five paid $9,800 with the favorite, Pete's Play Call, who ran very well in here. Mike Maker just keeps winning races, and it seems like almost everybody but the Wyckoffs were involved. Michael Way and Hooties and WSS, the partners, and Mike Maker pooling the resources, and Pete's Play Call under IRAD, very strong. Pick four paid $621. So it was part of what was really a fun afternoon. The race that, I guess, quote-unquote, got away, that just was maddening. And everybody jumped down Linda Rice online yesterday because Linda had said, ready for prime time, probably needed a race. And honestly, it's very possible that he really did. But nobody really, you know, was pressing. And back to his roots, who I talked about with Seth yesterday, and I at 9-1, I bet. And I don't blame Lascano. I mean, he's kind of watching, and I guess he thought that he could take down Ready for Prime Time at any point. But, you know, there were other horses that were supposed to be involved here. In this turf sprint, and they weren't. They just weren't around. So Linda wins 24.60, and people were like, she cold watered. Okay, she did, in fact, cold water a little bit, but I don't necessarily doubt that she thought Ready for Prime Time was going to need a race. So what are you going to do? This was a wincing loss because I don't know. I really kind of keyed a lot of things through back to his roots. Danny California goes his second choice and ran, I thought, a really nice race. This was the second Nota win of the day. And I tell you who's got himself a very nice horse, and that's Suge with Breaking the Rules. This was a very good performance following up his last, and certainly he's headed to stakes. And then in the nightcap, you know, there were two firsters in that maiden group, and the Al Stahl did seem like, you know, the one that might have been a little more eligible. And, you know, there was some sibling strength and more. And at that point, I actually was down in Albany at that point getting the computer fixed. And I waited 10 days for an appointment at Apple. So I was sort of engaged, but I was watching with one eye on the phone. And 0-60, literally, under Lascano, and lights it up at 16-20, Al Stahl. And that closed things out. It was a very good day of racing. And today should be the same. So looking forward to it. We got some other action, obviously, to weave in. Let me tell you what's going on before our first guest joins us. We'll stay here, Mark. Mark's on the board today for us. And I'll give you this number because I don't think it's – I'm positive it's not in the system. Dick Powell is going to join us in this hour, and we got a bunch to do with Dick, including some of the international results. We'll get some thoughts on how Dick's been hitting it at Saratoga, and we'll also look at Presque Isle, these early days as the season got started. We're going to talk to Tony, and certainly got to talk to Tony about what happened with Frankie. Pennington with that incident through the rail. Crazy. Steve Haskins going to join us, and it might pull out the hankies. If you didn't see this week on Monday, Steve's I can't call it a second career, like a racehorse, but he seemingly was retiring a few years ago from Bloodhorse, but then they kind of re-upped with him and brought him back, and this time though, it's official, and after another kind of a 5-year coda, Monday was Steve's last Bloodhorse column, and an outpouring of appreciation from everybody, and we will certainly talk with him about it, but we also are going to look forward to talking about the action too on the racetrack, specifically Maximum Security, get his thoughts, and look ahead to the Shared Belief on Saturday at Del Mar. And then some Whitney tales of Whitney glory, maybe, and so forth with Steve Haskin, Rich Eng as well, and more. Our first guest, and Mark's reaching out to Bob Elliston right now. And it's with real sadness. I mentioned yesterday late in the show that the word had come from Keeneland of the passing of Catherine McKee. And the first thing that that I thought of, and I did not know her. I knew of her though because of Rogers Beasley and her role as one of the administrative racing operations people, one of the point people that are on every racetrack, horsemen's relations, and interfacing with owners, interfacing with the horsemen, and it's invariably one of the most important jobs in racetrack management. And it, most often filled by women. And it there isn't a racetrack in the country that doesn't have someone like a Catherine McKee or a Carmen Barrera. And from last year, when Carmen passed in her sleep without any warning, the devastation involved here in New York, and for Keeneland horsemen and stakeholders, Catherine's passing has that same just heartbreaking element, and you saw, if you knew of this, you saw the widespread appreciation and sadness expressed. Bob Elliston joins us from Keeneland, and Bob, for stakeholders, for anybody that has ever raced at Keeneland, and for all the horsemen, extend our deepest sympathies to the family, the children, and everybody at Keeneland that loved Catherine.
Thanks, Steve. It's very kind of you to do so. She was a very, very, very special person. There's no question about it. And I love the introduction to the topic that you did, because because these are unsung heroes across our sport who go out of their way across unlimited, inadequate resources, logistical issues, competition, whatever it is. They just wake up every day to say, I want to take care of somebody and make their day better. And that's Catherine, and that's Carmen, and that's the ladies at the Preakness who take care of all those folks. We know them. Some of them we know by name. Some of them we know by reputation, as you noted about Catherine, having not met her. But she was the epitome of, I just want to make somebody's day better, whatever I can do. And she's going to be missed. There's no question about it, and not replaceable.
What's most challenging about this position is obviously the variety of people that you have to deal with, and invariably there's a percentage of them that are anxious and nervous and high strung and coming to a place for the first time, or even if they're not, generally, when it comes to stake coordination and people coming into, Keeneland, let's say for stakes opportunities, and whether they, they haven't been there. And so you have to have had an iron constitution and invariably, the ability to deal with, with all kinds of people that, in some cases are highly anxious and agitated. And that takes a special personality.
Well, you're right. It's two times. It's when they're making arrangements to come. And if they're flying their plane there, and how do they get from the airport to there? And in Keeneland on a Saturday, it's 35,000 screaming fans that you got to find your way through, right? Park your car and all the logistics associated, like it might be at Saratoga or at Del Mar. But so it's on the front end, calming them down to ensure that they're going to be in the right spot. They're going to have a wonderful meal. We're going to take care of them. And all they got to worry about is rooting their horse on. And then at the end of the day, 100 people come to the track, 10 of them go home happy, and the other 90 are upset because their horse didn't win, right? And then you've got to reassure them or make them feel as though it was all worth it. I didn't win, but daggone, I had a wonderful time. I was part of something very special. They took care of me, and it was memorable, and I can't wait to do it again. And that's what our business is about, because as we all know, there's a far, far greater number of folks who don't win on a day than do win. And the experience that people like Catherine tried to ensure those folks had is what's special and sometimes unforgotten, kind of overlooked in our business. And I will never forget it. I have grown from my time being in proximity to her and thinking about that person in the first race of a maiden claimer versus a grade one Shadwell mile race, treating them the same way and making them feel about that experience. And she is going to continue to teach us, and her efforts and work will continue on long beyond the very, very, very too short period of time she was on this earth.
How did she come originally to? She worked for. I know she worked for Rogers. How did she come to Keeneland to be a
lifer? No, she's a lifer. She interned in college. She got a job right out of college. I'll tell a story about her. One time in college, when she was interning, she may have joined some of her college friends over on the hill and had one too many libations. That happens on a wonderful day at Keeneland on occasion, and she got thrown out of the place. Right, because she had too much to drink. But I tell that story to laugh because we need to laugh, because if we don't, we're going to cry a lot and have been. But she got it right that very moment, because we would always laugh when we'd hear a story about somebody on a Saturday up on the hill, and Catherine said, can't be throwing rocks in this glass house. But my point in that story is it was always going to be about Keeneland. It was in college. It was as an intern, and it was for the 15 years she had no other job. And every single three or four years, she elevated her game to another position. And she continued to get moved up the organization in terms of her contributions. And she basically made all the trains run on time for Keeneland's racing program, which is arguably as prominent as any in the country, right? And so to be 33 years old and be in charge of that, it's a long way from getting thrown out of the place for having a couple of beers with your buddies when you're in college. And that speaks to her and her drive and her enthusiasm and her passion for all that was green in her, running through her body, the green of Keeneland.
Yeah, and you know, I think of Rogers and you know his reputation, and you can tell by this that I mean they must have really been an entry working together, because he obviously, you know, had total confidence and he could, you know, take care of the, you know, things that were coming his way and things that he, you know, he could have her address. And you know, it's one of the reasons Keeneland has, you know, the reputation and you know, the standing that it does with stakeholders in particular, and you know, yeah, making, you know, the two seasonal trips and taking, you know, every opportunity to, you know, to enjoy you know, what the facility offers in terms of racing and gracious you know, entertainment. As you said, this is one of those you know, seemingly impossible to replace members of the staff.
Yeah, I think another, so it goes to her initiative too. It wasn't just about service to others. She was a leader in her own right in terms of advancements for Keeneland and for the industry. She was on the board of the Thoroughbred Safety Alliance and developing the code of standards that hopefully every track goes through to ensure that from a safety perspective, we're doing all we can to have the safest racing environment. She was on that board at the NTRA in developing those protocols. She led our efforts, and many of the things that she insisted we did were best in class and hopefully transferable to other tracks. And then she would go on visits and help work with those tracks to develop those standards. So, you know, it wasn't just that she was playing this wonderfully supportive role of taking care of folks. She was leading in spaces that were very important. And that's pretty big stuff for a young person who also, by the way, was raising two young kids to be tremendous in the spirit of her and giving and charitable and upbeat and funny and all those things that we could say about it. She just, and I don't know how many hours in the day she had, but it was more than 24, I think, because she found a way to take care of it all.
And really, you know, as we referenced to start this conversation, Bob Elliston with us from Keeneland, and we're appreciating and paying tribute to Catherine McKee in the same way that Carmen had a certain New York way about her.
Yeah.
that really kind of embodied, you know, the Racing Association. Catherine had a different, you know, seemingly a very different kind of a presentation, but very much, you know, the face and spirit of Keeneland. And it's, you know, I you think about, you know, really, I'm thinking about the people that I know in these roles, Vicki Tomlinson at Churchill, and yeah, they all have, you know, sort of a beaming, you know, outward glow that is welcoming and, you know, just, you know, makes the race day go. And it's a lot of times anonymous, but I just know how important these cogs are, not just to the, you know, racing organizations, but really to, you know, to the horsemen and, you know, the owners. And it's they can't be celebrated enough.
No, and they have to be celebrated, even in the darkest hour like this.
Yep.
I mean, I can't wait till December 31st because I've had enough of 2020, and this perhaps is the unkindest cut of it all. But we can't, even in these difficult moments, we have to bring out these positives. We have to revel in the attitudes. I mean, Captain fought cancer for 3 years. I'll never forget. I was in New York for the Belmont when she called me to let me know that she had gotten the diagnosis. And she's like, well, we're going to fight through this. And for 3 years, she did. And she had up days and down days. And she never lost her smile. She never lost any of that. And what I think was most troubling for her was she couldn't be there with her team to do the things for her customers that she wanted to do. But I know she left... She left us a roadmap. She left us a perspective that we all are gathered around to ensure that we are going to continue at Keeneland. Most definitely.
Well, and I want to give the details too, and I just retweeted it for everybody. But there's a trust fund that has been established for the children and McKee Memorial Trust. Care of Keeneland Association, P.O. Box 1690, Lexington, 40588. McKee, M-C, capital K-E-E, Memorial Trust, care of Keeneland Association, P.O. Box 1690, Lexington, K-Y, 40588. And you talk about the year, Bob, and... I think the last conversation we had most recently with members of the organization were to appreciate Chris Caldwell.
Yeah.
I mean this is just this has not been a good couple of months. So hearts are with everybody. While we're together, I should really fold in the news from yesterday that you can pass along for those that may not have seen it. And it involves the sale. Yesterday, President-elect Shannon Arvin announcing the policy for attendance to the sale. Do you want to elaborate on this?
Well, I think it speaks to the definitive actions that we believe are needed in this time of uncertainty to ensure the safety of those who are coming to our facility from across the world and those who are there selling the horses and those on our staff that are a part of that. At this moment in time, to me, the availability of testing to ensure that at that moment in time you have not contracted the virus and able to spread it at that moment is something we all have a responsibility to do, along with a set of protocols that we're going to have in place, and we've been communicating with our customers to help develop these protocols. You know, Steve, and your listeners know how fundamentally important the September yearling sale is. This is the NFL draft. This is where everybody restocks the kitchen cabinet for the next 3 years, right? Every year to bring those horses forward. And that means a great deal to those that are coming to buy the horses, but all those who put their hard work into developing them and selling them. So we have to make people feel comfortable when they come here. And we have to make the people that are working there feel comfortable. And the second piece of that is, I noted it, it is the world's marketplace. And we are working very hard along with our congressional delegation and our U.S. senators to try to find avenues for foreign travelers to get here to the sale. And if they can't, then we've built out this robust remote bidding operation, online, phone, everything you can think of. We've got all those channels. My point in all that is to say, we're going to do whatever it takes to ensure the safety and the success as much as we can of that sale. And Stay tuned. As we know, these things change almost daily, if not weekly, in terms of the things that we're subjected to in terms of how we interact and conduct commerce. But we're going to do it in a way that makes folks, first and foremost, safe.
Well, and one thing that has to contribute, I would think, to the ease of executing this as well, Bob, is that the situation we have here in New York for Saratoga this summer, where owners are all, you know, getting tested and to be able to go visit their horses on the backstretch. And it's gone, you know, after a couple of first days with some frustrations, it seemingly has gone very well. And so I don't think this will be met with any, you know, resistance. And there's actually going to be on-site testing available as well, provided by Keeneland. The sale, of course, September 13th to the 26th. And, you know, between the Derby and Fasig and then Kentucky Downs and Keeneland, it's going to be an intense 3.5 weeks or so in Kentucky.
Well, and that's what, I mean, honestly, that's we understand that. And by the way, there's this little thing called the Breeders' Cup World Championships happening
on the back end
after October racing, right? In Lexington. So I think you're exactly right. I think folks understand their responsibility in doing what they can to stop the spread of this virus, and they want and will support people and entities and events that are doing the right thing by them. But that's where it is. Our 5-day July race meet, what's going on in Saratoga, the Derby, Labor Day weekend, September 12th, there is so much that is important on the calendar of horse racing and horse ownership in this fall. We've got to build the right foundation to build upon as we get closer and closer to opening and reopening things back to any semblance of normalcy. So I hope that's right. And thanks to folks like you that are spreading the word about that and making people understanding of what they're going to be subjected to. I think they'll be fine with it.
Catalog online when?
Should be here within the next 7 to 10 days.
Nice.
Which gets about a month. A little over 4,300 horses, some tremendous, tremendous pedigrees and physicals in there. As we see every year, these Keeneland grads went on the biggest stages everywhere in the world. So I don't think anything's changing. The breeders are bringing the goods. There's no question about it.
Well, we'll certainly check in as we get closer. And Bob Elliston, I sorry to have to reach out on the occasion of Catherine McKee's passing, but I wasn't going to let this go without paying proper tribute and drawing attention to the trust fund for her children and for everybody, again, industry-wide, our love and respect and appreciation.
On the contrary, I love talking about her and celebrating her, and thanks for your interest, Steve, and what you continue to do to be a place to have these great conversations. You have a great day, okay?
Bob, thank you. Bob Elliston, everybody, and Catherine McKee, way too young, and Carmen Barrera, similarly, and Catherine was sick, and everybody was aware of Carmen taken without any warning, in both cases, there's tons of people that had regular dealings with both of them that have to be heartbroken. So let me give it one more time, actually. Let me give you the details. McKee Memorial Trust, care of Keeneland Association, P.O. Box 1690, Lexington, Kentucky, 40588. Thanks to Bob for that. And couldn't have to take advantage of his proximity to yesterday's announcement from Keeneland and Shannon Arbin about the testing. So you got plenty of advance warning. And actually, the one thing it does not say is the proximity within, let's see, where is it? perform 5 days. So basically, you have to make arrangements for September 8th is when you're going to want to have your attending primary care physician or, you know, a clinic, whatever it might be, to, you know, find out 48 hours, 72 hours, how quickly they can turn around your test. And of course, not everybody is necessarily going to show up at Keeneland, you know, the first day of the sale, September 13th. I mean, book one and two, there's plenty of people who show up to shop books three, four, five. So within 5 days of your arriving at the sale, okay? Keep that number in mind. Dick Powell standing by, and he joins us now. Dick, good morning.
Steve, very good. Good morning to you.
Dick, as always with our visits, a nice variety of things to talk about, and we were looking forward to Enable's effort, and only had to face two, but she performed with aplomb, and then Glorious Goodwood this week certainly was engaging, and the Sussex, and we listened in to the stretch drive. How about some thoughts about the international results?
Yeah, the Enable race looked like it was going to be a tactical affair with three horses. One of Aidan O'Brien's horses scratched the day before. Anthony Van Dyke.
So, Anthony Van Dyke.
Sovereign went to the lead. Frankie kind of didn't want to get too close, didn't want to let him open up too much. Japan looked like he was in the catbird seat because all he had to do was follow Enable. But once they came out of the bend, and it was raining pretty good. Now, the ground never really got soft, but when it rains like that, the top of the ground can be slick. And within three strides, the race was over. I mean, Enable just went a whoosh.
Yeah.
And Japan could not respond. In fact, Japan dropped back and wound up finishing third behind the other Aidan O'Brien, Sovereign. So it was just a... You know, when you're 6 years old, you're not supposed to win by 10. You know, you're supposed to win, move on to the next target. And she's just doing that. She seems to be right on path for her attempt at the arc, and she's going to have a lot of company in that arc. That's not going to be an easy arc. But everything is going according to the plan so far. And it was also, it wasn't an easy race. It wasn't one of those races that's so easy, they don't get anything out of it. You know, she did the mile and a half in 2:28, and that was very, very good. And, you know, she quickened when she had to quicken and just looked like her old self. So she was very, very good. Then we go to Goodwood. And they have this series of distance races in Europe. They try to keep the distance horses running for more money, make them more prominent. And there was this bonus that they don't have this year, but Stradivarius has won all the races. So either he's not going to get the bonus this year, but he keeps winning all these races. Well, the Goodwood Cup, it's a big race. It's a Group 1, and he just did it again with Frankie, and he had some traffic with Nyef Road, and Aidan O'Brien ran Santiago, who was getting something like 15 pounds weight concession being a three-year-old and against the older ones. But end of the day, it didn't really matter. Stradivarius is going to, he's either going to beat you, you know, with authority, or he's going to just get into a slugfest and beat you that way. But the longer they go, Stradivarius just can just run all day. Now, what they're going to do with him, they're going to give him 6 weeks off, bring him back in Longchamp in the Pre-Foix, and that'll serve as his prep race for the Arc de Triomphe. So he's going to turn back to a mile and a half. Obviously, he handles 2 miles, and he's handy. He's not a plodding 2 mile type horse. And we've seen years ago with horses like Ardras and stuff, some of these route horses can handle the turn back, depending on conditions, depending on, you know, the race dynamics and stuff. So I wouldn't count out Stradivarius. He does need a new jockey, though. Of course, Frankie's his regular rider, and he's going to ride Enable in New York. So we'll see who John Gosden picks up for him, but he's just had a spectacular career and just virtually unbeatable going 2 miles. We then had the Vintage Stakes, which was interesting, Steve, because the winner was Battleground, and he won on during the Royal Ascot meet, Fraden O'Brien. And he's the one by Found, Out of Found by Warfront. So he won this race going 7 furlongs, and he was good. I mean, pretty dominant, in fact. But then after the race, the honesty just floored me. They said, well, we hope we can get a mile, but he is by Warfront. They're basically saying that even with a filly that won the Breeders' Cup Turf and the Arc and all these great mile and a half races, almost $10 million in earnings, well, you know, Warfront is not going to get you a mile and a half horse, even though the dam could get a mile and a half. So I appreciated that honesty. You know, they're in the business of selling horses and bucking stallions, and Warfront doesn't have any openings in his book. But it was just kind of a funny admission that they came out and said it.
Gotta appreciate that. It's every so often you get that kind of parallel. I'm trying to think of somebody that said something like that around here that on this side that is similar, you know, sort of saying, well,
we get it so infrequently that when someone says something candid, we're like, did he really say that?
Yeah, exactly.
And then we had the Sussex Stakes, and that was a really good race. That was a mile race, Group One, major ramifications, and kind of a messy race. Horses were kind of moving in, moving out, trying to get clear running. The couple of them didn't, and then the first to kind of Circus Maximus was involved in the pace the whole way, and then Siskin made his move, and he quickened just brilliantly, like he did in the Irish 2000 Guineas. So he looked like a winner, but then here comes Jim Crowley on Mohatar, and he had also been shifting in and out trying to gain clear ground. Well, he went outside of Siskin. So just as Siskin makes this move to look like he's going to catch Circus Maximus and remain undefeated, here comes the 4-year-old Mohatar and wins it going away for Shadwell and Marcus Tregoning. So he's a nice miler, and he's kind of stepped up to Group One company and did it successfully. So we'll see. He has a few more starts this year, and I don't know if he's Breeders' Cup bound or anything else like that. Siskin, I really like him because of the way he accelerates. He really quickens. And so that was a good race because, you know, 200 yards out, you still didn't know who was going to win it.
No, and I thought one of the parts of it that was pretty interesting, just a 6-horse field, and yet traffic became an issue. Hard to believe with a turf course that wide. Cameco was kind of hemmed in, and both times he tried to probe and find that seam, and it closed up on him, you know, in a jump, and never really got by the time their things had opened, it was too late.
Yeah, there were a lot of trips in the race.
Yeah, it's a 6-horse field. It's crazy.
But the winner was impressive, and I think Siskin showed that he can run against older horses going a mile. And obviously Circus Maximus just throws in the same top effort every time he runs for the Yarko family.
Yeah, he's the most consistent. No, he's as consistent as can be. Let's come back domestically, Deck, and turn our attention. We'll save Saratoga for next. Let's give a quick accounting of the first few days of Presque Isle. We touched on it the other day and got out in front of their opener. And you got 3 days in the books.
Yeah, they bigger fields than normal. That was a pleasant development. They're running Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday to start the meet out. Somewhere in August, probably 2 weeks, they'll pick up Thursday, so they'll go to four-day week. They're going into October 16th. I have to find the stake schedule on the website. I'm sure the Masters and those races are in the same spots because they have Breeders' Cup prep implications. So we'll check out the stake schedule to make sure. But, yeah, they had nice-sized fields, and racing was good. And the eighth race on Monday, and this is kind of your typical Presque Isle race. I'm looking at the chart, and I'm looking, every one of them was a gelding. The also one was a 10-year-old, some Samurai Sip. Nice and Easy, who was won, I don't know, 15 times at Presque Isle. He ran fifth, but he's coming off the layoff, so he needs a starter too. Another 10-year-old was in the race, a bunch of 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds. And these horses just keep going because they get on that Tapita, and it just extends their career. So you get these hard-knocking warriors that are just back every year. And that was great to see some of the old favorites back at Presque Isle.
Well, Fox Rocks. How about the whole meet started on that note with Fox Rocks winning the opener?
Yeah. Yes. 9 years old. Yes. Who has a connection to Saratoga, because her dam, she's a stone cold fox.
You bet.
Once shipped over here and won.
Absolutely. And I, you know what? I should dig out the chart because I think I might have been there for her. I'm now you got me. Now you got me curious because that when he started his career, he was right away. I mean, it's hysterical to go look at the horses he's run against, and you see name whenever you have a horse in advanced age 8, 9, 10, and you go back and you look at the first couple of years of the you realize, oh my God, this is so long ago. You see names that you know, some that have been standing stallions already for 6, 7 years. You realize how far back it goes. I've got to pull this up because there we go. All right, Fox Rocks, that's one of my favorite topics anyway. There we go. But she only ran 10 times, Dick, and that surprises me a little bit. She won the Futurity. She won the New York Futurity, and she broke her maiden at Saratoga. Then she won the Lady Finger.
Did Mike follow a trainer?
I think so. I'm almost... at the end, it was David Bell when she went up to Woodbine for those last couple of starts. But at the beginning, I think I'm pretty sure you're right. Let's go back all the way. I've got to see who she ran against in that. I didn't realize it was her debut. Langpap Stables, and it was Mike Ferraro, absolutely. And August 8th, 2001. And she brought John Grabowski. How great is that?
Right.
How great is that? Grabowski gets a Saratoga winner. And... Boy, you look at, holy cow, there's some sadness associated with that race because, Glenn DeSanto had a horse in, and so did Frank Alexander. Mm. Both gone. So, she's a Stone Cold Fox, Foxhound Philly. That I think when she started her career winning four straight. And she, you know, she ran in the 2001 Breeders' Cup in the Juvenile Fillies.
Yep.
Yeah, she won the first four starts of her career, and that was not a good experience for her in the Breeders' Cup. She was under 12-1 though. Jerry Bailey rode her. That was Tempera's. That was Tempera's Breeders' Cup at Belmont. A rough day.
Hey, the Fox Rocks paid $1,260 the other night. So.
Yeah.
With leading rider Pablo Morales, who wound up with 8 wins in the first 3 days of racing. Addy Alayala has 4. Scott Speed 3. Waba Allen Carr 2. Shelley. The rest of them have 1, and then Tim Girton, trainers, 2 wins, Leland Hayes, 2, Eduardo Rojas, 2, Shelley Radosevich, 2, and Jonathan Shepard has already shipped in and won a race, as did Tim Ham, whose profile has been raised pretty high lately.
We had him on last week, after the Saratoga winner.
Yeah. Yeah, so they got off to a good start, and if they can maintain the field sizes and stuff like that, what are we talking now? It's 4, I'm looking at the chart, 4:45 post time. So, like we've always said, if you ever get out there, it's a nice late afternoon. Well, I don't even know if you're allowed to go. I shouldn't say that. The way things are today, probably get out there and you don't get in. But I think the casino's open on a limited basis.
It is. It is.
But late in the afternoon with a longer sunshine and everything, it's a nice day.
Well,
8 races. No problem with that. So they got their meet going. And what did you say? They're about the last one that needed to get going? Everyone else is...
Them, and now, of course, we got Arlington as well going. So we're replete now. There's nobody other than the fairs that canceled. There's nobody that isn't running that wants to put it that way.
Yeah,
Dick, let's turn our attention to Saratoga and catch up. You were kind of wading into the action last week when we talked. What are you latching on to? What do you see? Certainly some, I think, this week, these first 2 days, and then going into today and, the weekend and that, the card that came up together for Saturday for the Whitney card, really good. And seems like, after, some... kind of okay slates to get going. It kind of feels pretty good this week. I've been fully engaged.
Yeah, I have also. The field sizes have stayed the same, 7.65. But what's interesting is the average win price is $13.72. And that's off a 33% winning favorite. So what you don't want in racing is a higher than normal winning percentage and a lower than normal average win price. Now, the win price can get skewed with the, a Matthew Poon special jacked the way up. But, when they've won 102 races now, so we're getting to where we can get bigger samples and stuff. So that's very strong. you would think that the field size might have affected that some. The field size might affect the win percentage of the favorites, but $13.72 average win price, that's very good. So if that can get maintained, that'll be good for the long-term health of the meet. There was one year at Saratoga where it was close to 40% favorites, and it was just, and I know some of the bigger bettors. I remember talking to Paul Corman at the end of the meet, and I said, "Paul, it's amateur hour. You're not going to beat this meet. It's a scouting mission for the next meet. That's just the way it is. These races were written, and the favorites are dominating, and it's hard to make money under these circumstances." And I like seeing $13.72. That's very good. So if they can maintain that, weather's been fine. We had some crazy rain the other day that the track barely got. That main track with all the resurfacing, that seems to be handling the rain and the drainage and everything else. So no one seems to have any complaints about that, which is excellent. And it's just a matter of how much turf racing can they withstand. It's 7 turf races on Sunday, and that takes its toll. And it takes its toll when it's dry. Everyone thinks, oh, when it's really soft, it's really going to tear it up. Well, yes, it will. But when turf courses are dry, they take a beating. So hopefully we get some rain. And, he hasn't had the rail down to zero yet. So the rail's been 9, 12, 18. This week it's going to be 18. So there is fresh green grass when they want to take the rail down and drop in. So I don't know if they would base that on, major turf stake races or something like that. But turf course is performing, and I was a little worried over the summer because it was pretty dry.
Right.
But we've been getting enough showers to keep it going in between the hot weather. So it's been fine. The meet's fine. I still maintain that someday we're going to have sports betting, real sports betting in New York, not what we've done, and have prop bets like who's going to be leading trainer, because this year would have been really fascinating. And it's not like everything has to be pre-flop. If you had leading trainer bets, yeah, you'd have to bet it before the first day. But then after the first week, you could come out with another line.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, Christophe Clement's winning everything. So Chad's price goes up and Clement comes down. Just stuff like that. I mean, that just creates a lot of interest. And it works in other countries. So with this trainer battle with Clement just doing what he's doing, and then that affects the jock race because Rosario's had so many of those wins that he's right up there with the Ortiz brothers.
Who seem to just win in bunches, too. Both, Jose and Arad. Arad falls behind, then all of a sudden, he won what? 5? Jose counters with a three win day. I mean, it's back and forth. I'm just looking here, kind of up and down the list, and Ricardo Santana got off to a very slow start, and in fact, he did get 2 wins. He got 1 win before Volatile, and I think it was on Thursday or Friday. I was going to bring this up and say, is Volatile. In fact, when it was, I was doing those props for the Thoroughbred Idea contest. And one of the props I was going to suggest, but then I realized it might have been rendered obsolete. Would Ricardo Santana Jr. have a win by the time he rode Volatile? And I guess it could have worked because he did get the win a couple of races earlier. He won for Rob Atrus. But Santana was, over 17 going into Saturday. And as strong as you know, his association is with the Asmussen barn, you know, there's a prop, you know. You could throw out you know, Dick as a, you know, as a sports bet proposition.
Oh, that's
over unders. Yeah, right. Over, yeah. Win over under, yeah. Win numbers for trainers and barn. You could do it for owners, and no doubt. There's a lot there.
Now, about Volatile, who is racing's Rorschach test. People watch the race, and a lot of people saw different imaginations from what they watched. I thought he was beyond brilliant. That, yes, he fell into the lead. Now, he's fast enough to have the lead, so it's not like he's some mid-pack horse who just wound up on the lead on a slow pace and did what he did. But come home in 22.94 with three grade one stakes horses chasing you with a big experience edge and everything else, and yes, you didn't use much energy to get to that point, but the running got real serious, and they weren't five lengths behind. They were a length and a half behind. And I just thought he answered more questions than if he would have just gone to the front and opened up a 1x5 and broke the track record. I was more impressed with what he did Saturday than if he did the typical gut the field and win by a wide margin. So I just thought he was terrific. It shows that it's not a fundamental flaw of speed figures, but you have to understand speed figures to understand, yes, that with an outrageously slow pace, you cannot have an outrageous final number. It can't be done. So pace had a big factor in that, and I'm sure that'll get noted in the performance figures and things like that. But I just thought he was sensational.
Away from Saratoga for a second, and on a similar note, the same conversation could be had about Maximum Security, and a performance that there were people on the internet saying they should just retire him right now. It's spit coffee out, you know, laugh out loud funny, because, you know, as Brad Free said on Tuesday, the horse had three or four different reasons and built-in excuses if he'd gotten beat. I mean, he could have easily not won that race, and yet he did. And you know, it's funny, the insults that are hurled in his direction, the completely unfair invective, I guess people didn't realize they were also smearing John Sheriffs in midcourt at the same time.
Yeah, it was. That was an expectation race. You got the horse who finished first in the Derby, horse who won the Saudi Cup, big expectations now with Bob Baffert, and he didn't live up to those expectations. He probably did everything that Bob wanted him to do, but there were these lofty expectations because of the path followed prior to the race. My negative on him in the race was there were a couple of times in the race I thought his stride looked awful. Now I know he's an odd horse. He's not your I don't know how to describe this. He's just not your typical smooth grade one type stakes winner that just blows you away as he runs by. There was a time when he went down the backstretch and I thought his stride was choppy, and on the turn he's not getting any response, and you know, he gutted it out, and it's a prep, you know, hello, it's a prep. Like, look at Saturday, look at this shared belief. How do you get a race to come up like that for $100,000 and it's not graded? I mean, that race came up super.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a prep, you know, just the way the crazy schedule this year, the West Coast horses have just the way the Santa Anita Derby wound up coming after the Belmont, and or a week before the Belmont, something like that. You know, that's just the way it worked out, and the sheriff stayed out there, and a couple of these others stayed out there, and so there's not much else for them to do to get ready for the first Saturday in September, so the shared belief is super strong on Saturday. Wow.
Well, we are going to lose. The expectation is that Uncle Chuck and you know, assuming nothing goes wrong with Thousand Words and Cezanne, Uncle Chuck and Anne O'Dor is coming to Kentucky for the Ellis Park.
Well, that's disturbing because I picked Uncle Chuck.
Well, I mean, he's there because. You know, if Baffert loses one or the other, you know, gives them an option of staying home. But I think you have to go back to the you got to go back to the drawing board. I mean, it's still, you know, the Honor AP Cezanne, and I mean, I remain a Thousand Words fan because I was there for, you know, so much of the early part of his career. It's gone, you know, a little sideways, but you know, I Los Al and the Futurity win and the Lewis and I think the Maiden win too. I think we were on hand for so. I was an instant fan of his, but we'll see. Baffert is hopeful that he's got him back, kind of going in the right direction. It's amazing to see a horse that it is essentially just, I don't want to say spinning his wheels, but he has not improved a step. From 2 to 3, and I know people are saying the same thing about Storm the Court, but that's not true. And you know, if there is a sneaky 3-year-old that nobody has got much of has really thought about as we angle toward the Fall Derby, it's Storm the Court, who has actually improved at 3, just a little bit, and I'm keeping kind of an eye on Storm the Court because Erton is no dummy.
Well, Saturday for me is rooting for Little Al. He's one of my favorites, and I think this horse is just awesome. I wish he ran him into Whitney last year instead of the Alley Bar. And he would have been first or second last year. He's just a terrific, terrific horse that Al's done a wonderful job with him. And
yep.
And I hope he can get and be Al's second Whitney.
Yep, with Blaine.
Up the chart. And, I love Code of Honor. I had a big bet on him in the Travis. And just think Shug handled him masterfully, and I think he's coming in. But I think Shug, based on what you hear Shug say, seems a little worried that he's not going to get much help up front.
No, there's not. This is the same conversation we kind of had last week regarding Volatile. And, you know, I'm not somebody that, you know, that gets crazed when stake fields aren't big and as big as we'd like, you just don't get the honest read. You know, you might get outstanding performances. You were extolling Volatile earlier, but without an adequate number of horses to, you know, create an honest pace scenario, you know, the variety of paces. You know, sometimes even in good sized fields on turf, you might get a field that is absent of, you know, of authentic pace. But that's, you know, that's part of turf racing's environment. But on the dirt, you really do. You want to have, you know, two or three horses that are interested in the front end and some, you know, some pressers and some stalkers and closers. You want the race to be run in a manner that, you know, gives everybody a chance no matter what their style is. You know, and when it comes to the highest level, that's what you're hoping for.
Yeah. And I think Code of Honor will run great. I think he's probably better at a mile and a quarter than a mile and eight. Just that the mile and a quarter gives him extra time to extricate himself from bad pace scenarios and things like that.
Yes.
But Shug will have him. He will have him ready. I know Al has his horse ready, and I know by my standards, there's no slouch either. You can't sleep on him and Kimmel's horse, and I'm leaving one
group.
Out.
It's a very good group, and it's going to be it's a terrific day. I mean, to have a Alan Jerkins like that, the way he came up, so. Dick, this was fruitful, and I appreciate it. Covered plenty of ground, and we'll do some recapping next week, and we'll have the Travers to go over.
Yes. Travers, really? It's the end of me? Football?
Hey, went so fast.
I meant to ask you, how was your first hand melon?
Have not had a melon yet. Have not had a Jersey melon yet. I don't want to say anything mean about the Hand family and the Hand farm. However, I learned there's two funny stories about the Hand melon. And I for years before I moved to Greenwich, before I knew Greenwich existed, and knew Washington County at all. This is in the early 90s or, you know, mid 90s until, you know, we started coming out here and then moved here. There was the lure, the ballad of the hand melon. And so I used to, when I'd go to and from Montreal, I would bring him back. And I remember, you know, extolling the virtue of going on and on about the hand melon. So I bring one back, and my friend brought one to my friend Genevieve and her mother, and you know, I cut it up, and there's all this anticipation, and she takes one bite and looks at me and says, "It's a fucking cantaloupe." It's a cantaloupe. What was the big hype? It's a cantaloupe, and I was crestfallen, and it's funny because then when I moved to Greenwich, you know, there's a much bigger farm operation out here beside the Hands, and that's BJ Farms.
Oh yeah, that's what I'm addicted to. That sweet corn.
Well, their corn's tremendous. I get Moses too. I go out to Moses Farm as well. Out, you know, Grandma Moses, the family has got a terrific in Eagle Bridge, and their corn is outstanding. And actually, I got corn the other day. Have you been to King's Dairy, King Brothers?
No.
Ooh, we're gonna have a conversation soon about King's, right up on near Bacon Hill by Winnie's, by the blueberry farm. Their corn was very good. I got a half dozen.
Okay, good.
On Monday.
I've been buying their milk in the store.
There you go. Good job. Well, I mean, the dairy.
I know Larry King is the stockbroker.
Is that a family member?
Oh yeah.
Interesting.
The King family covers a lot of ground.
Well, it's a sprawling farm. They also do beef and so forth. But the dairy store is unbelievable. I mean, the ice cream, outstanding. I've been something on an ice cream tour from Wilcox to Battenville Creamery to King Brothers, the trifecta of ice cream from Bennington to Greenwich to Schuylerville. To wrap up the tale of the hand melon, when I moved here, and discovered, you know, there was BJ Farms. And BJ Farms, here was the hand melon people selling, you know, the melon for $7. And the BJ people had a similar, what looked like the same melon. And it was like $2 each. And so for years, I used to bring them to the barbecue. I'd get a basket. They used to sell them off of a flatbed outside of Schuylerville. And I'd get like a basket of them and bring them to the track. They also used to have these duck pin sized watermelons with yellow flesh that were unbelievable. Unbelievable. How good. And I don't see them as often as I used to, the yellow flesh watermelon. But the hand melon only have a certain supply. It's actually what's known as a Jersey melon, and they just were, after a certain point, they're just putting the hand melon sticker on them. But it's not anything different. And so I'll give BJ credit. To their credit, they realized, why are we not selling these by the pound? And all of a sudden, the BJ melon went from $2 to like $5, $6, $7 themselves. and I, you know, good, for, not so stupid. So there's the deflating hand melon story. I'm sorry to be, you know, I hope I'm not destroying people's, their love of the hand melon.
Well, the BJ's corn was late this year.
About 10 days behind. They'll sell no corn before it's time, Dick.
But I have made up for that.
Well, and the best part is that it'll go until late September.
Yes.
Yeah, that's.
But I am at that point during corn season that I have to take a break.
We've been waiting. Tina has a policy. She, you know, she grew up in Hoosick Falls and you know, on and around farms, and so she will only have, you know, the best corn. She gets easily irked by what she calls cow corn. You know, that big tough. You know, she wants a delicate. You know, one thing that has changed. I will say this: when I was a kid, and I grew up, you know, east of the river in Connecticut, we'd pick up. We'd come back, typically coming back from Ellington Ridge, from a day of golf and tennis. It was like Bushwood. I was like Spalding. You'll get nothing and like it. We would stop at, there was a really nice stand, and it used to be, Dick, and tell me if this isn't true from you as a younger days, there would be three different varieties of corn. There'd be butter and sugar, you know, which was the white and yellow. Then there'd be Silver Queen, which was all white. Then there was a third variety that might have been all yellow and kind of a heavier corn. Now it's all the same. It's all the same, and we're, I think, you know, inviting a plague. Actually, they say that if a boll weevil came around, it would devastate the corn nationwide, because we're using, I think, like 80% of the corn is of the same variety now.
I think when you if you go to these farmers markets, you got a chance of having. I remember there used to be something called Illini, and it was a yellow corn, but it was really juicy and tasty. It didn't look like it, but it was. And I think that's where you, if you want the different flavors and things like that, I think the farmers markets are more likely to have it than the day-to-day truck stop.
Well, and certainly. When it came, now you're going to get me started on my screed on tomatoes, which now taste like nothing. They're now, unless you go get yourself an heirloom or a, you know, small farm tomato, they're from hunger. It's unbelievable what's happened. They've destroyed the pleasure of a decent tomato.
Well, there's a place right past McGregor Golf Course. And I don't know, there's a fork in the road, you go left, and then there's a vegetable stand, and you go inside there, and this guy had the greatest tomatoes. Big, plump, tasty, I mean, just, you know, and early. I think he has a greenhouse on the property or something. But I know what you mean. They engineer the taste out of everything.
It
appeals to more people.
Drives me nuts. Well, and also so they don't bruise. One of the real annoyances. You've managed to find one of my favorite pet peeves, because I used to appreciate when I was a kid and younger. You remember certain things only came around for little bursts of time, like nectarines. You could only get a nectarine for about 3 weeks. They came from the West Coast, and they were like candy. Now they're available year round, and they all suck. They're all terrible. They're all rock hard. They taste like nothing, or they're mush. They've also ruined Rainier cherries, where Rainier cherries were only available for about 16 days. And you'd pay a fortune for them. Now they're available for, like, you know, 5 months, and they're bringing them up from South America, and they've ruined those. It's so annoying. I would much rather only be able to have the best nectarine for 3 weeks than the alleged availability of them all the time.
Now, maybe you could write all these ramps down, and then the next Festivus celebration.
It's a grievance.
You could air all your grievances.
And Jay Hubdy is weighing in on avocados, which is another there's another area of concern, and I'm sure everybody's got. This every so often this comes up. People know.
I knew I would hit that flashpoint with the handmelon.
Dick Powell, everybody, with a crazy, funny 15 minutes. This was like Martini and Rossi. Thanks a lot, Dick.
I think it was more like Alan and Rossi.
Alan and Rossi. There you go. What did I say? Martini and Rossi. Yeah, exactly. Pretty funny.
All right.
Thanks so much. Dick Powell, everybody. Let's take the 90-minute break, and we've gone through 90 minutes somehow. We've done next to nothing. Back after this, we'll get Steve Haskin in here. Tony, if you're shopping and if you're in the car going into Wegmans, go ahead and shop. We'll get you on the backside. Back after this, Steve Haskin joins us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Ah, Saratoga. It's history. It's tradition. It's world-class racing. It's jump racing. Yes, steeplechase racing has played a role in Saratoga's rich history and tradition since 1864. And today, it's a part of what makes Saratoga so special. Watch every Wednesday of the meet and two special Thursdays featuring the Grade 1 AP Smithick on July 23rd and the Grade 1 New York Turf Riders Cup on August 20th. Savor the thrill of horses flying over fences. Steeplechase racing, it's a Saratoga tradition.
How's it going, Sue?
Hey!
Have you seen this commercial?
What career track are you on? University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program can prepare you for an exciting career in racing. Turn your passion into a paycheck.
Isn't that the horse racing school that Bob Baffert went to?
Yeah, Todd Pletcher too, and lots of other major players in every area of the industry.
Really?
Like what?
Well, for starters, we have graduates who are executives at Churchill Downs, NYRA, Darley America, Gulfstream, Keeneland, you name it. They're also regulators, racing officials, bloodstock agents, track announcers. My class had a job placement rate of almost 90%.
Wow. What other college program has results like that?
What career track are you on? The University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. Enroll today and get on track for success. Nearly 90% of our students are employed in the racing industry immediately upon graduation. For scholarship opportunities and more, check out our website at ua-rtip.org.
Sirius XM Sports presents...